You're listening to the 1 Peter 5 podcast.
It is a real joy for us to welcome you all here.
Habemus Papam.
Rebuilding Catholic culture, restoring Catholic tradition.
Hello and welcome to the 1 Peter 5 podcast, episode number 47. My name is Steve. I will be your host today, as with every other day on the podcast. This is our first attempt at doing a video podcast. Now, the audio files will be about the same, so you can listen to them on your favorite podcast subscription services, iTunes, Stitcher, what have you. But we're going to add the video component just to see how it goes, because last week we discovered that people like it when we do videos, and so it's something that I thought we might give it a shot and see how it goes. There's two stories that I want to look at today, and I suppose in a way you could say they're somewhat interconnected. The first story is about Pope Francis and what he said to one of the Chilean sex abuse victims by the name of Juan Carlos Cruz. You're probably familiar with this story because everyone is talking about it. Here's the thing. Juan Carlos Cruz met with the Pope in Rome within the last couple of weeks. And it was to talk about the abuse that he had suffered at the hands of Father Fernando Caradima, and also to discuss the complicity of certain other prelates, like, according to Juan Carlos Cruz, Bishop Juan Barros. But during that discussion, his sexuality came up. Juan Carlos apparently is gay. Now, this is something that seems to be very common amongst men who have been abused by other men when they were young. I don't know. I don't have any statistics on it, but I feel like I have read a number of stories along those lines. And this seems to be no exception. The reason his sexuality came up, according to Cruz, is that some of the Latin American countries' bishops had sought to depict him as a pervert and to accuse him of lying about the abuse that he suffered. The Pope, however, told Juan Carlos, according to Cruz himself, quote, "that you are gay does not matter. God made you like this and loves you like this, and I don't care. The Pope loves you like this. You have to be happy with who you are." Clearly, this is a statement that's a bit of a problem, a little bit more of a problem even than the "who am I to judge" statement. It's interesting to note that the Vatican press office did not respond to questions about whether this was an accurate depiction of the Pope's comments. Here we are again, where we have somebody who has no reason to lie saying the Pope said something to them that was controversial, and the Vatican press office and the Pope are silent about what was actually said. But we have reason to believe it. Obviously, you know, the "who am I to judge" comment sort of set the framework, and he repeated it twice. And it was about a homosexual priest who works for him, still does. And I'm talking an actively homosexual priest who has been caught with young men on more than one occasion. Not a celibate homosexual priest, who's just doing his best. So, there's a lot here to unpack, and I don't know that we have a good grasp of this issue. No, I would say I know that we don't have a good grasp of this issue. What people don't know, is whether homosexuality is a product of nature or of nurture. I mean, that seems to be something that has been in dispute for a long time. The American Psychological Association has changed its tune on it. I mean, originally they thought it was a mental disorder, right? But over time, people's views on this have changed, and we've undergone the agenda to forcibly normalize homosexual behavior and relationships. And that's made it incredibly dangerous for any researcher who wants to continue to have a job in their field, who wants to get funding, who wants, you know, to be honest about findings in this regard. The narrative, the accepted narrative, is not one that would allow for the idea that people are not born gay, that it's environmental factors that tend to lead them in this direction. And this is why I would like to talk to someone who is particularly outspoken on this issue. Somebody who's lived it, who's walked a mile in those shoes and did so for many years. And that man is Joseph Chambre. Joseph Chambre, of course, we've interviewed him in the past, lived a very active homosexual lifestyle in San Francisco, a very depraved life by his own admission, very dark years. And at the end of a period of time, he couldn't take it anymore, and he left very close to death, very sick, physically ill from the toll that his lifestyle had taken on him. And through the power of God's grace, he was able to repent and find conversion, which is phenomenal. But Joseph, having lived that life, will tell you, you're not born that way. That's not how God made you. God didn't want you to have these disordered inclinations and desires. And he has a ministry called Jesus Loves Gay Men, and he goes to these, displays of debauchery that happen on the streets of San Francisco, the Folsom Street Fair and things like that, and, you know, stuff that would make most of us turn away pretty fast. And he goes right into that heart of darkness, and he brings rosaries, and he teaches these men who are living this life that God loves them and that God wants them to come home. He's incredibly brave, an incredibly brave man, not afraid of the consequences of what speaking out against, you know, these issues in a way that's unpopular will cost him. And it's cost him a lot. So I'm trying to get Joseph on the horn. We connected very briefly earlier today, and he said he was heading out, and we haven't been able to connect since, but I'm really hoping to get him on the show here for just a few minutes, because I've already seen him making some comments about this on social media, and he's not a happy camper, but I would like to get his perspective. The second issue that I want to talk about today is in a way related to the first, and that is a follow-up on the story of Michael Smolanskis. Michael Smolanskis was a senior at Providence College in Rhode Island, a Catholic college, a Benedictine-run college. Michael was required by the school, as part of his job as a residence advisor, an RA in a dorm, to maintain a bulletin board with informative topics of his choosing. And he chose earlier this year to put up a bulletin board depicting the church's teachings on traditional marriage. Marriage is one man and one woman. He quoted the Pope talking about how, you know, a child has a right to a mother and a father. He quoted the catechism. This was pretty benign stuff. It was Catholicism 101. He puts it up. He begins immediately to suffer harassment and intimidation for this. His bulletin board gets vandalized. The school campus security has to move him to another undisclosed location because they're worried about threats to his physical safety. He, before he's moved, walks into his bathroom one night and sees a hand-drawn cartoon depicting him being raped, being forcibly sodomized by another man who is saying, "I told you, Michael, you shouldn't have put up that bulletin board." The school did nothing. Michael had to call the police. He got a faculty advisor. The faculty advisor was aghast at the fact that the school seemed to only find the entire thing to be a nuisance and blamed it on Michael, that he caused all this trouble. So we have talked about that. That was actually our last podcast. I interviewed both Michael and his faculty advisor, and we wrote up an article on this. And several other Catholic publications did the same. Well, Michael didn't exactly receive an exoneration, but the president of the college, who is a priest, did issue a statement reluctantly, but condemning the threats against Michael. And that seemed like maybe it was the end of the story. But see, this past weekend, Michael graduated. And right before he graduated, he received a new threat. And you won't believe what happened next. We'll talk about that coming up next.
You're listening to the 1 Peter 5 podcast.
John Smolanskis, magna cum laude. Shalana Ruche Smart. Grayson
Shapley Smith. With me now is Michael Smolanskis, who was a senior, just graduated from Providence College in Rhode Island. And Michael has a little bit of a story to tell as a follow-up to the podcast that we did last time, episode number 46. I gave a little bit of background on this, Michael, in my intro to the podcast, talking about just sort of a recap on what had happened when you put up your bulletin board and the reaction that you got, and then the president of the college issuing a kind of weak, arm-twisted response that just seemed like it was more of a nuisance to him than anything. But it kind of seemed like, to me, maybe this situation had come to a close. But that really wasn't the case, was it?
No, the hope was that, you know, something more would come, and it never did. And like you said, the president issues some kind of response, but their great hope, it was obvious to me, was to sweep this under the rug, let me graduate, and hope that the problem never returned for them so they'd never have to deal with it.
So, how much time has elapsed since the president issued his statement?
I would say about a month, roughly. It had been quiet for a while.
About a month, it's your senior year, you're focusing on finals and getting ready for graduation and all that kind of stuff, right? So you're probably not, I mean, you're more aware of this than anybody else maybe, but maybe not thinking about it so much because you're trying to get done, you're getting ready to get married.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, that statement came out, it was unsatisfactory, but from that point on, it was, you know, finish the courses, write the papers, get that diploma, and try to plan a wedding in the middle of all of it. So sort of on the back burner.
Yeah, a couple things to do. Busy. So then what happens next? Because I got an email from you over the weekend. You were supposed to graduate. It was Sunday, right? You were graduating on Sunday, this past Sunday?
Yep.
Yeah. So, and I got an email from you, I think, Friday or Saturday night, and you were like, you're not going to believe what happened. So tell the listeners what happened.
Exactly. Yeah, it's sort of a two-part story, but they're connected. Over the course of the final week here, they throw a number of events for the graduating senior class, one of which is a formal dance event that was held in Connecticut at Foxwoods Casino. And, you know, my fiance and I, we showed up, we dressed up, we paid like everybody else did. And we were sort of late to the ticket buying. So we were placed at a table of people that we didn't know. You know, it's a large enough college where you're not going to know everybody in the class.
And, sure.
You know, so we sit down at this table and things were pleasant. You know, we were all enjoying our food and our appetizers and sort of mingling about. And at a certain point during the dinner, or right before the main course came out, somebody at the table put two and two together who exactly I was. You know, it started with sort of, oh, there's the guy who put up that bulletin board about marriage. And, you know, the grumbling and the whispering sort of circulated around the table. And finally, the questions started be coming directed at me. You know, are you that guy, that awful person? You know, yes, I am. And, you know, oh, so you must hate gay people. And, you know, why did you do that? You're such an awful person. And for a while there, they just kept telling my fiance and I to leave. They just, you don't belong here. We were told at one point, this was my favorite line, this table is only for people who support same-sex marriage.
Hold on. These were other students, or there was a mix of students, parents, faculty?
Just students.
Students, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, of course, this is the tolerant group talking here, saying this table is only for people who aren't like you, so you should leave. And, you know, we proceeded to tell them that, you know, we paid for our tickets and we were going to at least eat our food and, you know, we'd move on with our night. And, you know, so there was sort of some back and forth there, but, you know, I told my fiance before the week started. She said, can this week just be be pleasant and enjoy, you know, the time we have and not have this be about the bulletin board. But of course, other people made it about the bulletin board. So, you know, we sort of carried on with our evening, and I get approached shortly thereafter the meal from one of the guys who we were sitting with, and he asked me to step out into the next room because he wanted to have a chat. And so I said, you know, okay, I would prefer that someone talk to me about it. I was trying, you know, not to get my fiance involved and ruin her night.
Right.
So I stepped into the next room, and he started telling me that, you know, his date was all upset because, you know, she didn't want to sit with a person like me at the table. And, you know, we should have just left. We should have just left, and, you know, we didn't belong here or whatever. And I proceeded to, again, explain to him that, you know, I paid, I'm here, I'm a graduate, you know, I'm going to enjoy my night. And on top of it, you know, what kind of person are you to, you know, sit across the table and tell people to just leave? And so there's, you know, sort of going back and forth a little bit. And one of his buddies joins us, and he proceeds to start threatening to murder me.
What kind of murder are being used? I mean, murder is a big word. Is it the whole, you know,
that word is wrong.
Or?
So that's actually how it started. The word murder is the word choice that this guy who comes over is using.
But I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh at that. That's ridiculous. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, and so, well, that's the thing, because people have said to me, oh, you know, people get mad and they say, you know, I want to kill you, or, well, I guess some people do.
Right.
And I've told everybody I told the story to, I said, it wasn't the kind of angry, maybe had a few drinks, I'm so mad, I want to kill you sort of comment. It was, they repeatedly, or the one guy who came over repeatedly asked for my home address because he wanted to find me, stab me, murder me. That's what the questions kept, you know, asking were, where can we find you after graduation so that we can murder you? And so it's the one guy who comes over, he's really the one threatening me, but the other kid who I'd originally been talking to, he's the one telling me that the sort of being asked to leave the table, the threat, sort of, this is a natural follow-up. This is, as he said, this is what I deserve for putting up ignorant things like that.
So you deserve to be ostracized for not being tolerant.
Yeah. And then, you know, with the pattern of things, I suppose I deserve to be raped and then murdered.
Right. Right. Yeah. All of the above, clearly. Mm-hmm. So you're there and you're recognizing this is like crazy hostile, aggressive behavior. What's your reaction?
I mean, you know, in the heat of the moment, it was, you know, like somebody said to me today, sort of, how much of this can you take? You know, it's been however long this has been going on. And I told them right there, I was like, you know, guys, this is insane. And, you know, if you've got a problem, you know, we're going to handle it right here, right now. And, you know, I'm certainly not going to give you my home address to find me. But, it, you know, it was pretty tense there for a little while. And when they sort of realized that I wasn't, you know, cowering in fear or anything, it sort of dissolved and dissipated. Everyone kind of went their separate ways. But, you know, they and it was clear they're sort of taunting me to try to get me to, you know, I don't know, maybe throw a first punch or something, which, of course, I wasn't going to do. There's sort of this baiting going on. That's fun.
I mean, you know, there comes a point where you get enough of these threats and you may not have given them your home address, but you're double checking the doors at night, right? I mean, you don't know what's going
to
happen.
Well, of course. I mean, I came back to my, you know, still on campus, so my dorm room that night, and, you know, have it locked from the inside and things like that. I mean, it's 2018. I mean, threats aren't hollow. You know, people do crazy things. So
yeah,
it's serious. Yeah,
clearly. I mean, there have been multiple shootings just in the last week over nothing. I mean, this is a crazy time to live. Okay. So you get these threats, and obviously just like, you know, the rape threat, but, oh, it's a cartoon, so it's a joke, right?
Sure.
You take it seriously, and I'm assuming you call the police.
Yeah, so the next morning, I mean, my father is a police officer, so the next morning, you know, he's sort of my first phone call, and
right.
He's like, you know, you got to report this. We have no confidence that the college will do anything, but you have to report it to, you know, the police. So always sort of start internally, file the report with public safety here, and then they were the ones who filed the external criminal report with the local police where the dance was being held in Connecticut. And so that's, you know, seems to be a good route. There's the internal, you know, hopefully these guys can be held accountable here if the college would actually do anything. And then externally, I mean, this is, you can't just walk around in society and threaten to murder people. So, you know, there are real life consequences too.
Right.
And the public safety department took it extremely seriously. They actually kept asking me, why didn't you call us sooner? You know, So there's a great level of concern there. And after those reports were filed, my understanding is that they pulled those two guys in who had you know, talked to me that night in for questioning and statements and things like that. And so public safety is taken very seriously. In the meantime, I sent out an email again with no confidence that things would happen, but I guess, you know, you hope that if there's, they didn't do anything about the rape threat, but if there's anything worse than rape, it's murder. So maybe this one will catch their attention. And so I sent an email to, you know, the same group of administrators, just informing them of what happened and telling them, I told them, I said, you have contributed to an environment where students feel like it's okay to behave this way. You did nothing really to denounce a threat of rape. So why do you think your students don't feel like they have license to behave this way? So you're responsible for it. And I received a sort of, you know, legalese vanilla email back saying, you know, we appreciate your concern and please let us know if there's anything we can do for you. Because as far as I was concerned, they should have been barred from the rest of the commencement activities. I've heard of people who have been barred from participating in these commencement activities for much less than threats of murder. So then I received an email from public safety later on in the evening saying that the request would be processed next week through, because we have sort of a system of, you know, student conduct violation enforcement, and that's who would determine, you know, what sort of consequences, at least internally, those students would face. And they said, we're not going to touch it until after, conveniently after graduation.
But of course.
So it was, so nothing.
Well, at least they're consistent.
Right, exactly. I mean, they consistently do nothing, so...
So then you told me, though, that you had a run-in with somebody in the administration graduation weekend?
Yep. So that's why. So the threat part is sort of part one, and it's connected to what happened on Saturday afternoon. We had an awards ceremony, and then we had the commencement mass. And after the mass concluded, I was waiting for my family with my fiance, waiting for her family too. And, you know, there's sort of a sea of people exiting the building. It was held in the gymnasium. And so there's just mobs of people. And I could see Christine Goodwin. She was the vice president who in the past encouraged people to march against me. She was sort of the one who most gravely mishandled the bulletin board thing last time. She comes walking towards us in our direction, and she was the one who had responded to my email to the administrators about the death threat. She was on, and she was the one who provided the response or lack thereof. And so as she's approaching, I'm thinking to myself, you know, I want to say something to her. I mean, she, as a college top, you know, level employee, vice president, ignored death threats between students. I'm going to say something. And I think most people would. And so as she comes by, I said her name a couple of times to try and get her attention. And she just blatantly ignored me. And finally, you know, I said her name again, and I said, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. I was threatened with murder and you did nothing. I said, you can live with that for the rest of your life. Period. That was it. She kept walking. She never responded. I didn't, you know, follow her. It was period. She kept going. And so we link up with our families, and they're having a reception outside. And I get a phone call from public safety, who said, I know all the public safety guys real well now. And so the interim chief down there calls me, and he's like, Mike, what's going on? And I said, you know, what do you mean? He said, well, I just got a phone call from the vice president, and she's claiming you threatened her. And, you know, of course, I was pretty surprised.
Did she want them to?
Oh, absolutely. So he's.
Oh, no, it's okay. When she perceives a threat, that she makes it up.
Right. And so that was, you know, the great irony of the whole thing was they would process the other request next week, but she wants immediate action when it concerns her. But of course, there was no threat made against her. It was just calling her out for her inaction.
Right.
And so I explained that, you know, to him. I told him exactly what I just told you. No, this is the encounter I just had with her, you know, 15, 20 minutes ago. And he says, well, first of all, you need to come down to public safety because we have to write a report and you need to make a statement. He said, secondly, the legal counsel of the college has issued a no contact order on you, which is basically the college equivalent of a restraining order.
So hold on. Did they ever issue that against anyone who has made these threats and harassment against you?
They did put one on the student who made the threats of murder.
Okay.
They did put that on him. So, and that's this typical, I mean, you know, between students, it's not, you know, even if students get in a physical altercation, you know, fist fight or something, they'll pull those out. But not between students and administrators. I have never heard of that before.
Right. Especially when you make a threat. I mean,
right. I mean, and that was determined before they even talked to me. It seemed it was up. Oh, she made a complaint. You know, here's the restraining order. And so he says, you have to come down, make the statement. They have the no contact order on you. And he said, as it stands right now, you might not walk at graduation tomorrow. And so, again, this is, you know, we were celebrating, you know, on the campus lawn there with, you know, my family and some professors and things. And it was like, wow, you know, way to ruin the day.
So they weren't going to do anything about the guy who threatened you with murder before graduation. But they were definitely willing to do something to you for simply saying your inaction is shameful.
Yeah. It became apparent to me that they were looking for something. And, you know, all it took was for me to speak to her in her direction, not even to her. She didn't acknowledge it. Speak in her direction. And she was ready to prevent me from going to my own graduation. But so I, you know, of course, is really taken aback. And, you know, we went with my father down to public safety, and, you know, they're of course, they're just doing their job, and they take orders from, you know, the administrators. And yeah, went through that whole process and everything. And it came to light that basically they tried to make a wager with me. They said, this was coming from the administration and the legal counsel, if Michael makes a formal written apology to the vice president, Christine Goodwin, we'll consider letting him walk tomorrow. And I said, that is the last thing that I will ever do, A, because I did not threaten her. So my apology would be, you know, admitting that I did something that I didn't. And secondly, in light of everything that this woman has done to me, I was never going to issue an apology. And so they said, well, Michael, if you don't submit this apology, then it's looking like you're not going to go to your graduation tomorrow. I said, well, that's the price that I suppose I'll have to pay. You know, that's just not going to happen. And so the way we left it was, like I said, the reports, the no contact order, they're asking for an apology. And they said, well, we'll get back to you around 9:30 tonight to let you know what they decide is your fate for tomorrow. And my fiance's family is visiting. She's from the West Coast. You know, they're out here and we're all trying to have a good time. It's a celebratory weekend. And, you know, this woman has a personal vendetta against me and, you know, proceeds to sort of ruin our celebration.
Your fiance's got to hate this too.
What's that?
I said, your fiance's got to hate this. I mean, my wife hates how much garbage I put up with from people.
Yeah. And that is, like I was saying before, with the formal dance there, you know, I tried to move on. We moved on with our night. I mean, I was done with those guys and I found her. I said, okay, you know, let's go dance and let's go have a good time and, you know, tried to prevent this from ruining it. And here we are, you know, the evening before our graduation, just fresh out of mass and the award ceremony. And my fiance is, you know, in public safety because she's a witness and they want a statement from a witness. Her father is there and we're all sitting there going, you know, geez, you know,
honey, look at the life we have ahead of us. It's going to be great. This is what happened for principals in 2018.
Exactly.
So, okay. So they make these overtures, they make it seem like you're not going to be able to walk. They're, you know, really trying to threaten you. Then what happens on graduation?
Well, they realized they couldn't get anywhere with the claim of a threat because in the short time that I was in being questioned and then my fiance was in there, they told her that what they were going for was behavior unbecoming of a Providence College student. So it moved from a threat to, well, we just don't really like what he did. And so anyways, we sort of carried on with our night. We go out to dinner. And at 10 o'clock on Saturday night, I get a phone call from the head of public safety. And he says that, you know, basically they're still toying around with it. Or sorry, this is a little earlier than 10 o'clock. He called me in the interim and they're still deciding. But he said, if I can promise him that I won't, what he kept saying is pull anything at graduation, that they'll let me walk, because they said in light of recent, you know, school shootings and all these things, I was perceived to be a threat, an unpredictable sort of loose cannon, and that they were concerned. So if I could promise the public safety director that I didn't have anything planned, that they would, you know, maybe let me walk. And of course I assured him that, you know, I'm not going to do anything at graduation. I just want my diploma like everybody else. I haven't done anything here anyways. And I, you know, I would like to walk. And so he sort of brought that back to them, I guess. And he's been very good. He's sort of been fighting for me all along. And finally he called back around 10 o'clock that night and said, well, they're going to let you walk. He said, but the conditions are that Christine Goodwin gets a personal bodyguard, for the day for graduation. Which, unfortunately for the public safety director, who I've gotten to know very well, he's a very good guy, it was him. He had to be the bodyguard.
Sure. Well, so, Mr. T was unavailable, so.
Right. And so he had to be at her right-hand side all day, including sitting up, you know, on the front stage through the whole thing. So she would get the bodyguard. He informed me that there would be, regular police officers there, but there'll also be a number of undercover non-uniform officers, as I was told, ready to haul me out if I did anything, which the way it sounded to me was if, you know, I made any sort of sudden movement, you know, or swatted a fly, I might be getting dragged out by my feet.
I mean, how much of this do you think is theater? I mean, was any of the, were they really making preparations for this? I mean, but if you think someone is a credible threat, you're not going to say, well, if you pinky promise that you're not going to do anything, exactly, then we'll let you go be at this big public event where you could, you know, do whatever.
Right. And that's, I mean, basically it's irresponsible on their part in either way. If they actually thought that I was a, like you said, a credible threat that could harm a large group of people, then you shouldn't have let me go. But it's clear that you're playing some sort of other game where you just really wanted to get back at me. And so you were going to try and, you know, I don't know, scare me, or, you know, they want the apology or whatever it is. But right, either way, it's questionable behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't okay. So graduation happens and you walk and nobody throws rotten fruit at you or anything like that.
No, you know, the graduation, you know, surprisingly well, I thought maybe some booze or something. But that all went fine. And, you know, she was sitting up there with her guard and, you know, all things sort of went well. As far
does
as
that. Anyone take this woman seriously?
No.
There's no way. You can't take somebody like that seriously. So, okay. So good. The good news is that it went off, you know, well, all things considered, but now what? I mean, you must feel some relief, right? I mean, you're finally graduating from this place. You're still crazy enough that you're getting married there, which I would never do, but God bless you. But what now?
Yeah, you know, the big relief was to get that diploma in hand. I sort of had every fear that they would, you know, try and mess with the hard work that I put in over the past 4 years. So I have that securely in my home that can't be taken away from me. And, you know, still sort of deciding what to do here with this stuff. I mean, it's such a multi-layered issue. You know, it all stems from the bulletin board incident and being, you know, in that sort of hostile RA work environment. And, you know, really just, I don't know, taking a step back and considering, you know, what that means, where to go from here. And, you know, as always, I want to tell my story. I want people to know what's going on at these places. So I'll continue to do that. And, you know, in the immediate future, still trying to put the last pieces together for the wedding.
And, which is when it's coming soon, right?
Yeah, it's a little over a month. So that there and you know, move on with job and all of that. So just would like to settle into a relatively normal life, but I also have my suspicions that this is the first of many.
Well, Michael, you have so much to learn about setting your feet on this path. Never. But, you know, the good news is that you have started off, you know, right in the thick of adversity. So I think you're going to be ready, at least, for what comes next.
Yeah, I've told people that I think my last few months here at PC are sort of boot camp for the future, because things aren't getting better. We're definitely under assault, and you have to be ready at all times, I think. So.
You know, what, 6 months before they start calling you as an alumni asking you for money because they treated you so well?
Well, the way they, at least the way they do things here, they've already started asking us for money. I said, no, you won't be receiving any.
Oh, my goodness. Well, This is a crazy story. I'm glad that it's coming to an end. What would you say to any Catholic parents, actually Catholic parents, considering sending their kids to Providence College? They need to hear it.
Well, the sad sort of you know, dichotomy here is that I would tell any Catholic parent not to send your child to Providence College if you want your Catholic son or daughter to be safe here, to be able to live out their faith openly and freely. And to receive a good, solid Catholic education, I would, sad to say don't send your kids here. But on the flip side, you know, this place needs strong Catholic, you know, guys and girls and strong Catholic faculty and, you know, building those relationships. So if the place becomes empty of, you know, strong Catholics, then it doesn't stand any chance. I mean, as it stands right now, it doesn't stand much of a chance at you know, getting where it needs to be. So there are good options elsewhere. So make good use of those.
All right, Michael. Well, congratulations on graduating. Congratulations on your upcoming wedding. And thank you for sharing your story here.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here again. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Hi, I'm Steve Skojak, publisher and executive director of 1 Peter 5, and I'm sorry to just pop in like this, I mean, literally on your screen, but I just wanted to make a very brief personal appeal to you. You see, this month, like every month before, 1P5 is out there providing the best Catholic news and analysis you'll find anywhere online. And this month, like every month, we're providing that free of charge. There are no subscriptions, no obligations, no paywalls, not even one of those overlays that won't let you read the website unless you turn off your ad blocker. I can't stand those. At the same time, 1P5 is a 100% reader, listener, and viewer-supported enterprise. We cannot do the work that we do without you. And so I'd like to ask you, if you want to join your voice to ours, if you want to amplify your concerns about what's going on in the church, if you'd like to put your money where our big, loud mouth is, and it's loud for a reason, please stop what you're doing and go to 1peter5.com/donate right now. It doesn't matter if you don't have much to give. Every bit helps us in our mission of rebuilding Catholic culture and restoring Catholic tradition. We'd like to thank those of you so much who've donated so far this campaign and those of you who will do so in the coming days. God bless you and thank you all for your readership and your support. With me now is Catholic author and evangelist Joseph Chambra, who left the gay lifestyle and now spends most of his time performing outreach to members of that community to encourage them to know that God loves them and wants them to come home. Joseph, how the heck are you?
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen.
It's been a while since we've talked, and a lot has happened since then.
Yeah.
So I hope you're doing well.
I'm good. Yep.
That's good. Let me start with the tough question on this issue that everybody's talking about today. Is anybody born gay?
No, absolutely not. No.
And why do you say
that? No, it's just, well, I mean, beyond, I guess we could start with just, I mean, not even the American Psychological Association agrees with the born gay theory. You know, if you go to their website, they say there's absolutely no there's no evidence, scientific evidence, that anyone is born gay. And they say that I mean, they qualify that and say there's factors, there may be biological factors, and it may be a mixture of the biological and, you know, mm-hmm. environmental.
Yeah.
So, you know, they say right out front, the APA, that people are not born gay. And I mean, they've been looking, I shouldn't say they, but scientists that want to find a gay gene have been looking for one for, I would say, going on 40 years.
Yeah.
And they have never, I mean, and they've done twin studies and they've done, you know, cadaver studies of the brains of gay men, and they've never
found anything,
because it does not exist. And then if as a Catholic, and we're talking about Catholics who recently are promoting this idea of being born gay, mm-hmm. I mean, in the Catechism it says that, you know, that the orientation itself, or in the 1986 letter specifically, it says it, the 1986 letter to the Catholic bishops on the pastoral care of homosexual persons, it specifically says right there that the orientation itself is a disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, beyond having the desire for same-sex relations, that the orientation is a disorder. Therefore, I mean, if we believe as Catholics, and I hope everybody believes this, that we have a loving God. God the Father is a loving God, and He would not on purpose, create anybody with a disorder, with an intrinsic disorder.
Right.
I don't believe He would. And people, you know, who have same-sex attraction and identify as LGBT and gay, they believe that as well. They don't believe in a sadistic God. that created them disordered. Therefore, they reject church teachings, you know, including the catechism. They reject that as false.
And that's
why you have priests like James Martin who say, well, it's not disordered, it's differently ordered. And I mean, it's that's their way to get around it and say, well, yeah, we are born gay. People who have same-sex attraction are born gay. And church teachings are not correct and they need to be modified and changed. So
what do you think? I mean, you know, that's so you have that perspective from sort of a theological and an ontological basis. I mean, in practical experience, you know, you've known a lot of people who've gone through this. I mean, what do you think the catalyst is for most people? How do they wind up, you know, if it's a disorder and they're not created with it, how do they wind up going down that road?
I'm not following you. Going down.
Well, I mean, it's a nature versus nurture argument, right? So nature, I mean, if there are elements of nature, I mean, somebody could be more or less effeminate. Somebody could be more, I mean, there are certain characteristics that we can see, but I mean, you would argue that it's mostly nurture, right? So how does that end up happening? In your opinion?
Well, first you got to start with how many people, let's stick with gay men, because that's the majority of the LGBT population.
Right.
A lot of gay advocates, you know, inflate the number as much as 10% of the population is LGBT. Gay men is about 2% at the most. So it's rare.
Right.
I call it a perfect storm, or you have the perfect gay boy syndrome. And you mentioned that too about effeminacy. I mean, some people, you know, I'm not saying they're born gay, but I was one of them. I was kind of a slight kid. I was thin, you'd say kind of frail. I wasn't sporty, and I had certain, you know, I had an affinity towards, you know, art and things like that, things that might be considered swerving more towards the feminine, you know. So, I mean, that kind of set me up. But not, I know a lot of straight guys that are that way too.
Right.
And they're not at all gay.
Yeah.
Well, there's got to be more. And with me, you have, you know, a critical or disinterested or absent father. So that's another thing in the mix. And then you also, this kind of boy, a lot of times does not click at school, which I didn't do. So you have teasing and a lot of, you know, bullying at school. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of times too, here's another aspect. You have pornography, somebody that's interested in pornography and gets into porn. And then you also have molestation.
Yeah.
And then, and then you just have an entry point where someone, and I live, you know, I've always grown up in San Francisco and around here. So I had a way into the gay community. So not everybody has all of those aspects going on, but they usually have about three.
Yeah.
And typically I would say the most significant one is a bad relationship with the father. But again, I know a ton of straight guys that talk to me and say, you know, I had a horrible relationship with my dad and I'm not gay. But there's other things, there's other factors going on that they did not have. They might have had good relationships at school with other boys, or they were involved with sports, or they had an uncle, you know, that cared for them, or just other things that were going on that they might have tipped into gay, but they
manifested, you know, those things differently. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but a lot of those guys, a lot of times too, is it had like bad relationships with their dad. I talk with them. They've got other stuff going on, like porn addiction. They've had bad relationships with women. You know, they've had alcoholism, drug abuse. You know, so the dysfunction in their childhood, it manifested in different ways. It didn't manifest into homosexuality.
Right.
Which is, like, again, is rare. Only about 2% of guys are gonna go that way. So
let me ask you the question then of, so the Pope makes this statement and he says, you know, is alleged to have said, I mean, it's one of those no, the press office of the Holy See will neither confirm nor deny, and the Pope isn't saying anything about it. We've seen this a million times before. But we do have two instances in the past of him saying, who am I to judge about these situations, on the record, both of which, or at least the first one of which, was in reference to a priest who works for him who has been caught in engaged in active homosexual activity. He's not a celibate at all times, at least. So there's certainly some context in which we can say this isn't outlandish. So he makes this comment and he says, you know, God made you this way and the Pope likes you that way and you don't have to feel bad about it. What sort of an impact does it make on people when a Pope makes a statement like this, especially people who are same-sex attracted, people who are, you know, adolescents and they're trying to figure out what to do, or they're trying to struggle with the church's teaching? I mean, what have you seen?
Well, you know, because I outreach in the gay community in San Francisco, I've got my ear to the ground, so I kind of know what's going on. And, you know, the LGBT population are not stupid. And they're not disinterested in the Catholic Church, even if they're not Catholic, or, you know, they're not even particularly religious. A lot of them are kind of irreligious, but they're just interested in terms. They're just interested in anything that has to do with the LGBT population. So the community, so they know what goes on in the Catholic Church. So I know that, and it kind of doesn't matter what the Holy Father intended or whatever when he said that who am I to judge comment. But I mean, it landed him on the front cover of The Advocate. So it made a huge impact in the gay community. And I still hear it when I go to Pride. I mean, somebody offered me a who am I to judge, you know, t-shirt, and I, you know, refused. You know, I thanked them that I turned it down. So they very much see this as a softening in terms of church teaching, pastoral, I mean, everything. Because, you know, I've had these conversations with them, and I say, well, you know, the church, really, this is what the church teaches. And I try to explain them, and they say, we think it's going to change. We think the church is going to change. And unfortunately, and specifically in San Francisco, but in all the major cities where you have a gayborhood, you know, Chicago, New York, L.A., whatever, there are parishes that are also perpetuating this, what I think is a myth, this myth that the church is evolving on this issue. And it's eventually, I mean, they even think that eventually they're going to be married with in the Catholic Church. So there's other forces involved here that pick up very quickly what the Pope might sort of misfire when he speaks, and they pick it up and they completely run wild with it. So, I mean, I'll be at Gay Pride on June 24th down in the city, and I'm sure I'm going to hear God made me this way, you know, a million different times. So it's very detrimental. But what's very sad about it too is, like, the Holy Father was speaking to an abuse victim, a victim of priest sex abuse. And I mean, probably any first year psychology student would know you don't make any, like, big assumptions about somebody that's a survivor of a child sexual abuse. I mean, whether later in life as an adult or a teenager or whatever, they got involved with homosexuality, drug addiction, you know, alcoholism. I mean, I would never make an assumption about somebody like that and throw out something like,
well,
that.
I mean, this, like, you were born the story
gay,
that
because the... it's I mean, to me, because I'm an abuse survivor as well. I mean, I find it very offensive, just because when I went to Catholic priests, and this is the Catholic Church in, you know, miniature, but when I went to a Catholic priest, and he didn't know anything about me, about my past, that I had been abused or whatever. And I talked to him, and right away he was like, well, yeah, you were born gay, and, you know, you'll settle down, you'll meet somebody, and, you know, things will work out for you. Jeez. And it's so patronizing, and it's just, you know.
Well, I mean, I know you've said this to me before, but it never fails to amaze me that you're getting that kind of counsel from priests. And
I have guys today after all this hit the fan. I've had guys email me today that say, yeah, a priest told me that I was born gay and I just need to, you know, be cool with it.
Yeah. And so the church is perpetuating this problem. You know, and I'm scrolling through the headlines here from a few other publications, you know, America, the Jesuit Review, LGBT community cheers Pope Francis, God made you like this remark.
I'm sure they're cheering.
Yeah, the Telegraph, Pope says it's okay to be gay, says Chilean clerical abuse victim after Vatican audience. The Guardian, Pope Francis tells gay man, God made you like this, you know, and then the LA Times, Pope's reported comment to a gay man may indicate a new level of acceptance of homosexuality. So it's just one after another.
Yeah. Well, the Vatican, in defense of Juan Carlos Cruz, who I think is probably one of the bravest men in the Catholic Church right now, I mean, because people are online, I see him saying, well, he lied, he's doing this, he's got mental problems because he was an abuse victim. That's really awful, too, just to say that.
Yeah.
But, the Pope, the Holy Father cannot come out now and say that Juan Carlos Cruz has lied. Because, I mean, he's already accused him
of calumny
earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a disaster any way you look at it, because this poor man, he's been through so much. And I think he earnestly, I don't think he was trying to cause a scandal. I think he earnestly, you know, believed that that's what the Pope said, and that's what the Pope said to him. And I think he felt that was something charitable.
The thing is,
he repeated it.
The story is that the reason that this came up at all was because some members of the Latin American bishop conferences were allegedly accusing him of being a pervert because he was a homosexual and that he was a liar and all this kind of stuff. And so this seemed to be where the question of his sexuality entered into the equation. And then the Pope's like, hey, you can't listen to that because God made you this way. I like you that way. You're fine. So that's sort of the segue. But the thing is that these allegations, that who was saying it? Nobody's saying who was saying it. So, you know, you wrote a very heartfelt post today, I think, about the toll this kind of thing coming from within the church takes on you. I mean, ever since your conversion, which was years ago, I mean, it's probably a decade now, right? I mean, or more.
1999.
Yeah, so even longer. But the temptations that you experience to just walk away and throw your hands up, you know, how do you think Catholics need to deal with this kind of thing? You know, I don't even know if I would say that it's a misguided attempt at a charity. I really kind of feel like it's an intentional distortion of the truth with the hope to change the way we view, you know, sexual moral ethics, right? I mean, is that off base?
I don't know. I can't determine who has that agenda. I mean, I would say certainly James Martin has that agenda. And I would say that certainly like New Ways Ministry, Dignity, and then like the different, you know, the different LGBT ministries that bishops have allowed to flourish in their diocese. I mean, the most egregious one is out at St. Paul, which is supported by the Paulists in New York City. The stuff that ministry promotes is completely against church. I mean, they promote gay saints, they promote gay Jesus, they promote gay marriage. I mean, you name it, they promote it. They have meetings at gay bars. It just goes on and on and on and on. So, I mean, those particular individuals and groups are clearly looking down the road. And I mean, they've said it. Like, out at St. Paul did a whole video series where they interviewed and the pastor from St. Paul the Apostle, the Paulist, he went to Rome and presented the video to the Pope, and, you know, he had pictures taken, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. So in that video, the members of that group, the lay members of that group who are gay and identify as gay, said, you know, we are staying in the church because this is the only way that the Catholic Church is going to change, because, you know, we are staying, you know, we're
right.
Staying put. God bless them. That's their belief. That's, you know, that's what they want to do. So, I mean, There are those, and unfortunately, there are bishops, I mean, some very high up, Tobin, who, the one, McElroy in San Diego, Supich in Chicago. I mean, they've been pretty explicit in their support for these type of ministries. Some, I think, have just sort of been, I don't know, like Dolan, I don't know. I don't know what he's doing, why he won't just at least forbid these groups, but he's tacitly approving of them because he doesn't do anything. So these groups have been effective. I mean, and like you said, I think it's misplaced charity. They've appealed to bishops and cardinals, and, you know, priests on the parish level. And they've told these stories about how they have felt alienated and discriminated against by the Catholic Church, by individual priests, and so they've been able to open up. This is the untold story in the Catholic Church right now concerning this topic, is that these ministries have been able to just run wild and unchecked, and you know, they're breeding grounds for all of this dissent. And what James Martin has unwittedly revealed, because he sort of hopscotched around the country going to all these ministries and spouting all this stuff. You know, he says, well, my book doesn't contain anything, you know, heretical. Right. But he goes to all of these ministries, which is true. But he goes to all of these ministries and he spouts all this stuff up off to these people that believe it. And it's madness.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, obviously it's damaging, it's spreading, it's becoming more and more of a problem. And it takes a toll on people like you who are trying to reach these people and say, this isn't what God wants for you. You're not going to find happiness there. Yeah. Please come home.
Yeah, Stephen, it makes me sick. Because, literally, because this is taking a toll on my health. Because I went in, and I don't want to belabor this story because I've written about it so many times, but I went into the gay world, you know, in 1988 at the height of the AIDS crisis, and I went anyway. But you know, by the early 90s, I saw so many young men dying of AIDS, and if they weren't dying of AIDS, they were dying of drug overdoses and suicide. You know, it was so tragic. It was a miracle that I survived. All of that. And, you know, I got out of gay. It was just so horrendous. And I didn't understand at all what the Catholic Church taught about it or how they pastorally outreach to people that have same-sex. I was very naive. I didn't understand anything. So, but I did read the Catechism, which has three short paragraphs, and I thought, well, this is the church for me because they're saying, yeah, you don't do it. You don't be gay. You know, you don't do gay, you don't do gay stuff, you know, so I just, this is what I want. But the reality was so different and it was so shocking to me because, you know, I just felt like I had escaped from this death camp in San Francisco.
Right.
Where gay men were sequestered down there and were dying and were murdered. And I couldn't understand why anyone in the Catholic Church, which has the truth about homosexuality and homosexual acts and how evil that is and how detrimental it is to the soul and the body and everything. I couldn't understand why they were still having that debate about it. And I just kept thinking, you know, like, gee, 300,000 gay men in the United States alone have died because of this lie.
Yeah.
Isn't that enough? How many bodies, I mean, how high does the pile of bodies have to get until you say, no, you don't go there. You don't send somebody there.
And yeah,
you don't play these games with the rainbow flag. They do this all the time. The church in San Francisco is the rainbow flag. After all of these years, after all the blood on that flag, you know, they still have it hanging outside the door. And I said, how long are you going to play this game? That, there's nothing redeeming there. I don't care. I know some people, good people, who you know, identify as gay, and they do have loving relationships, but I don't care. It's still detrimental to their body, and it's detrimental to their soul.
Yeah.
And there's a fast highway there, with no detours, with no way to get off, that goes right to hell in the gay community. And I don't get why there's this debate in the church about it. I just think it's over. It's over. I mean, after the fall of communism and people knew about the gulags and everything, you know, that sort of debate was over. But I don't know why this still continues. It's very disheartening.
Yeah, they've managed to just maintain this level of cognitive dissonance about what's really going on. And really, it's through euphemisms. It's through hiding, you know, the effects that it really has on people. I mean, it's one of the things that you've done.
Well, the media is complicit. You know, I grew up in the AIDS with I grew up in the era when AIDS was in pop culture with And the Band Played On and Early Frost and all of those sort of TV shows and movies. You don't hear about AIDS anymore, but people continue to be infected and die of it.
Yeah,
because it's inconvenient.
Well, I mean, here's a disturbing story. So earlier on the show, I talked to a young man who just graduated from Providence College in Rhode Island. And it's a Catholic school. It's a Dominican school. Earlier I said it was a Benedictine school. That was wrong. It's a Dominican school. The president is a priest. And right on the front of their website, they have this big thing about their Catholic identity. And, you know, you'd think that this was another Steubenville or Christendom. But this young man is a residence advisor in a dorm, and one of his jobs is to put up informative bulletin boards in the wing that he lives in. So he put one up earlier this year about the church's teachings on marriage.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
You heard about this story. So he was harassed. He was intimidated. Yeah. He was threatened with rape, with you know, forcible sodomy for putting up the board. The school would do nothing about the threats. He had to call the police himself. He got a faculty advisor. The faculty advisor couldn't get the president of the college, a priest, to issue a statement condemning the behavior. So this went round and round. And finally, you know, there was enough media pressure that the president came out and gave this sort of, you know, you twisted my arm, fine, I'm irritated, but I'll say that it was wrong for them to do this, but we also have to be tolerant, kind of a thing, you know? And it seemed like that was going to be the end of it. But he talked to me today because this was his graduation weekend, just, you know, this past weekend. And during the dinner that they had leading up to graduation, some people realized that he was sitting with other students, that he was this kid who had done this bulletin board, and they threatened him with murder. They said that they wanted his home address so they could come home and stab him, and, you know, all these awful things that the police took very seriously, the kind of threats that they made. He's there with his fiance. You know, and so then he goes and he brings this again to the attention of the administration. They do nothing. So he walks up to this woman who's the vice president of, I don't know, student affairs, something. And he just says to her, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself because the kind of threats that I'm receiving, and you're doing nothing about it. So she reports him as a threat. She says he threatened her. They basically issue a restraining order against him and threaten him with not even be able to walk at his graduation. Now, he managed to actually receive his diploma and do this, but she lied. She got a bodyguard to protect her. All of this is because he put up a bulletin board with a quote from the Pope saying every child has the right to a mother and a father, a quote from the Catechism. There was nothing inflammatory on this bulletin board.
It's No. That's a microaggression. So
yeah, but I mean, it's a Catholic college that broadcasts its Catholic identity until you get there.
It doesn't matter. No, I have a question for you, Stephen.
Sure.
Because I'm not. I mean, I'm kind of familiar with the case. Now these threatening, you know, utterances that were said to him. These were other students.
They were other students.
These were not. These are other students.
Yeah, other students.
Okay. Well, see, this you know, this kind of substantiates what a contention that I have made, because I outreach to the secular gay community all the time, the LGBT community, these are people who are, I don't know what their religion is, and I have never found them to be difficult to deal with. I would say 90% of the time. For lack of a better word, term, the gay Catholics mm-hmm. who I've met, I've never met such vicious, intractable people in my life, because I've dealt with the same kind of things, threats and all of that stuff. So they feel very, and it goes back to all this born gay garbage, they feel very entitled. They feel like God created them this way, and if you are standing between me and God, which they think you are doing, me or I or anyone in the church who doesn't buy onto this this born gay theory, they feel that you know you're a detriment and you need to be removed.
Yeah, I mean, and they told this poor kid
that the church wants to go this direction.
Well, they told this kid he doesn't deserve to sit at the table with them or be at that college or go to the graduation because this is what he believes. And he's like, I graduated from this school. I paid for this dinner. I did all, but they use the words, you don't deserve to be here. And it's scary to me because it's not just that it's the gay Catholics. It's all the young Catholics who think it's okay to be gay, and they're not, but they'll go to bat for it.
Yeah. Okay. I am gonna have sympathy for those people, those young people that talked so awful, because this they didn't pull this stuff out of the ether.
No.
This stuff is being fed to them.
Yeah.
And it's being fed to them by bishops at the top, who, not directly, but they're allowing it, the priests and the professors who are allowing all this. The onus is on them.
The church needs an exorcism. I mean, at this point, I don't know what else to
do. It needs to clean house. There, you need a bishop, at least in his diocese, just to clean it up and say, enough is enough.
Well, and he's in the diocese, strangely, of the good Tobin. You know, there's the bad Tobin and the good Tobin, and the good Tobin actually kind of put some pressure on the college, but I don't know. You know what it's like. You go to these dioceses where the bishops have great reputations, but then when these issues come up, they back away as fast as they can get away from them.
The gay one is one that none of them want to touch.
Yeah, because so, I think it's gay, a hornet's
the
nest.
The gay issue.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you one final question. You know, with all of this in mind, if there's something that you could ask for priests and bishops to do when they encounter same-sex attracted people or people who are already living in that lifestyle, what would it be? What is it that these people should be hearing from the church?
Priests need to, and I've been meditating on this, priests used to have as their model St. Joseph, my patron saint, not just because he's my patron saint, but I think he's the model for all manhood. Mm-hmm. St. Joseph was very kind. He was very compassionate. You know, God the Father allowed this mortal man to hold the Son of God, you know, close to his chest. So St. Joseph was a good man, but he was a compassionate and he was a tender man, but he was also a strong man. And he was also faithful, and he was also obedient. And that's what priests need to do with these young men. I'll just stick to the young men. The young men that they might encounter who are suffering with the same-sex attraction, compassionate, but obedient and just strong. We don't need these flaky, funny, sarcastic, patronizing priests that unfortunately are all too often involved in these ministries, because a lot of times they're the only ones that want to do it.
Yeah.
So I wish the priest that probably feels like he doesn't want to be involved with this kind of ministry, maybe he feels like he's not right for it. He's probably the one that's exactly right for it.
Yeah. It's kind of exactly like the guys right who should it. Be a bishop. Like, they're never the guys who want to be a bishop.
No, I mean, like Bishop Paprocki, I think, you know, it's so interesting because he's from Springfield, which I assume I may be wrong, but I'm assuming it has a very low LGBT population. But he's been on the forefront on this topic. I think he's been very compassionate, but he's also been strong, and he's clearly stated what the church teaches and what priests need to do. And I just wish they would all do that, because I think, you know, it's not a big a deal as people think it is. I think they've conflated it. And I just think what I needed when I left the gay community, because I never, ever had any sort of, except gay men. Gay men were the only ones that reached out to me. They reached out to me to have sex, too. But, you know, they reached out to me. So when I left San Francisco, I just wanted a man who could just listen to me, but also just guide me on what to do. And thank God, you know, through Latin Mass communities and, you know, being introduced to, you know, the Tridentine Mass and the priest, I found, you know, a priest that was compassionate, kind, but also very strong and willing to guide me and say, well, Joe, this is what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And he was looking out for me. He wasn't trying to ingratiate himself, you know, through me.
Yeah.
But he cared enough about me to say, Joe, this is what you got to do. And thank God I met him. And there are priests out there like that.
Well, thank you, Joseph. God bless you and your work. And I encourage all of our listeners and readers to pray for you, because you are in the lion's den every day. And I know it may not feel like it to you, because there's a comfort and familiarity there on some level. But, you know, like you've said, most volunteers don't come back twice. It's not an easy thing that you're doing. And so we're very grateful for you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the 1 Peter 5 podcast. This has been a production of 1 Peter 5 Incorporated, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. If you have downloaded this podcast through iTunes, we encourage you to go there and leave us a review to help others find and enjoy our show. If you would like to support our work, go to onepeter5.com/donate to make a tax-deductible contribution. This not only helps to pay for web hosting and the fine content we provide, but keeps food on our tables, coffee in our cups, and the lights on, which really helps us see what we're doing. Until next time, I'm Steve Skojak. Thanks for listening.